Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Thank you for supporting it. Thank you for supporting the people that support us. And let's get behind all those people that make this possible and keep the wind in the sails of the Corolla pirate ship. Don't forget, I'm doing a streaming show every day at drdrew.com. Also, YouTube/Dr. Drew, Facebook/Dr. Drew, wherever you're hanging out. Usually around 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, we'll do a stream sort of updating. Lately, it's been a lot of coronavirus stuff. And don't forget After Dark, man. If you haven't been over there at your mom's house, we miss you, and I think you'll like it. Today, I'm welcoming John Roa, entrepreneur, technologist, philanthropist, inventor. His book is A Practical Way to Get Rich and Die Trying. I thought it was or die trying, but and die trying. Also, his podcast, The John Roa Show, R-O-A, at John Roa, Twitter, J-O-H-N, and website roa.com. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Drew. How are you?
Good. And die trying? Explain that piece.
It was a crazy adventure. And, I do feel as successful as it was at the whole, I lost a part of myself in that journey. And despite being very close to actually dying in the journey, there were some things that were sacrificed. And that's not a topic we talk about enough in the entrepreneurial game.
Let's get into it. What'd you miss? What have you lost?
Well, it was crazy, man. So
I'm sure relationships are something that most entrepreneurs know you lose, right?
Relationships go quick.
Yeah.
And my first one was an early teenager, my best friend who I grew up with. We started a business together. He then stole the business and my money, and that was my first lesson. And so it went from there. I'm 36 now. My first business was at 14, so 22 years in this game. Eesh. And gained and lost a lot. And it's a story that as I've met more entrepreneurs, more successful people in my life, I realized my story is not that uncommon. We just don't talk about it. And that's why I wanted to kind of put it out there in a book.
Keep going. So that's a friend that, he violated your trust and was being a bad person. I'm sure there's more sort of incidental losses just from working too hard or being too preoccupied, that kind of thing.
Yeah. some incidental and some, pretty much a byproduct of self-destruction. But as the risk and pressure and stress built of being an entrepreneur, I was 26 years old, found myself running one of the fastest growing companies in the U.S., very little experience. I basically failed high school, failed out of two colleges, finally fumbled through a degree, and basically didn't know what I was doing. Felt like a fraud the whole time. Really didn't believe I deserved my own success. And I found myself self-sabotaging that success.
Dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
The imposter effect is pretty common, right?
Yeah, the imposter syndrome, yeah.
And usually people with imposter syndrome actually do know a lot. They just know that when you know a lot, you don't know anything.
That's exactly it. And, I think it comes with, I can only speak to tech entrepreneurship. What's interesting is when you research imposter syndrome, you hear about, Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, or Tom Hanks telling the public that they don't deserve their own success.
And they're
like, well, that's ridiculous. But when you go through it, you really do believe that you have faked everything. You are a fraud and you deserve nothing. And at some point the shoe will drop and you'll be discovered. And that is a horrible feeling.
Well, that now I kind of feel like that's not a universal experience. I believe that a lot of celebrities feel that way, and that's what leads them to do all kinds of crazy stuff, including substance use. At its core, there is a lot of shame sitting there. So where did the shame come from for you?
I think the shame came from, I grew up in a situation that there wasn't a ton of outlets for opportunity. I grew up in an immigrant household in a suburb of Detroit. My dad came from Venezuela. And so when we grew up, we had enough to be fine as a family, but not much else. And so I didn't really believe I was going to have a ton of opportunities to break out of that cycle in my life. And even when I became an entrepreneur and started getting involved in technology, I still didn't see that as an opportunity. I just enjoyed computers. I'm a big computer nerd at the core. But then all of a sudden in my 20s, you build this company and you feel like you did it kind of by accident. I was struggling. I was broke. I didn't really know what else to do. And so I went back to my normal, which was trying to build things and trying to make an opportunity for myself. And then all of a sudden it starts working and people start depending on you, believing in you, photographing you, interviewing you. And it's like you're still thinking back to the guy who failed school, who's been told their whole life that they're probably not going to make it, who's not terribly smart, or at least you don't believe you are. And then all of a sudden people are telling you the opposite. And so you are caught between the two worlds of what you think you're supposed to be. And you are out there preaching that you are, you know, that this is all deserved and you're a genius and that, you know, you're owning that mentality. But then as soon as the cameras turn off and you're back home, you're struggling to believe any of it's true. And it's a very difficult middle ground. And I think you're right that it's not universal. I think it's people who are probably more self-starters, definitely more creative. It can be a pretty vicious cycle we fall into.
And did you understand going in that these were sort of some of the risks, or did you have any sense of what
not
it meant
all.
To be an entrepreneur, or why did you sort of go down that path and not just get a job?
You know, I didn't even know what the term entrepreneur was probably for a majority of my life and career. I hadn't known any as a kid. No one in my extended family are entrepreneurs. I just am that kind of brain that is built for solving problems and taking risks. And you know, the biology of entrepreneurship has been studied recently, and it's really interesting to hear that there is a lot more to it than just people who like starting companies. We are built for this the same way athletes or actors might be. Mm-hmm. And it's as much of a curse as it is a blessing. Our propensity for risk is kind of matched with our propensity for mental health issues, for other sorts of things. You know, Dr. Michael Friedman's figured out that about 73% of us have diagnosable mental health conditions.
Where primarily does that sort of, what does that center around? Mood disorders?
Yeah, a lot of it's mood disorders. You know, I think the kind of cluster A stuff, the depression, bipolar, the anxiety is really high. I think it's 8 times higher for bipolar for entrepreneurs than the general public.
Well, now there's an interesting thing that goes on in entrepreneurs, which is successful entrepreneurs are typically hypomanic, right? And very typically. I mean, Trump is a good example of this. You know, he gets up at 4 in the morning, all this stuff.
Right.
A lot of the constructs that I've been seeing are starting to depathologize that hypomania that you see in entrepreneurs. But I'm wondering, in spite of that, there is that risk in certain subsets of the group that flip into mania. And I'm betting that the manic stuff really comes in if people start using substances.
Listen, it doesn't help. And I went there.
Because you start getting so exhausted and you start traveling and then just a little sleeping medication. Now the sleeping medication is hanging over, just a little stimulant, no big deal. That's a recipe for cooking mania.
100%. And I think you're seeing it in a lot of people, our president included, but also.
Well, but he has this weird phobia of substances because of his brother.
Sure.
So if he were a normal entrepreneur, he would have gotten into that cycle for sure.
Right.
So
that's exactly it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you think back to like Kanye West's, you know, admission to David Letterman about his level of bipolar.
Yeah.
And then his behavior afterwards. And so, and by all accounts, he is CEO of Kanye West Inc., right? That guy is a hardcore entrepreneur, as well as a typical musical creative. So, you know, I think you're seeing it quite often. And then the problem with business entrepreneurship, the more classic like tech entrepreneurs, is that we don't talk about it in real time. You only hear about it in retrospect. Mm. So you don't hear about these stories until normally there's a disaster or somebody has come out the other side and talk about it like me.
Right.
You never hear about it in real time. Well, so until Aaron Schwartz took his own life or Colin Kroll took their own life or whatever, or Kate, you know, until these things happen, you don't really know this is going, you know, through your day to day.
So you mentioned Kate Moss. You put her in this category.
I didn't mean Kate Moss. I mean Kate Spade.
I knew who you meant. Weird.
Yeah.
I interpreted
both
meant
the right word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kate Spade. I do. 100% I do.
Yeah. And to that point, did you ever contemplate talking out loud during your early entrepreneurship, feeling like an imposter and sort of externalizing it and saying, or was it too shameful to then say that? It would expose you to too much shame to say, hey, I don't feel like I deserve this, or I really feel like an imposter here. I'm just a regular guy trying to make this thing go.
You know, it's interesting because there were definitely times where I felt deeply aware of my own imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other times where whatever side you were kind of the pendulum was swinging to felt absolutely real. Like there were times where I would stand on stage and deliver a speech and I would finish it and feel like I got this. I deserve this. This is where I belong. This is me. I am the CEO that everyone requires me to be and expects me to be and believes I am.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day I would wake up shaking and say like, none of this is real. I'm, you know, someone's going to walk in my office and say, we figured you out. You're a fraud. And I believe that 100% that my business was going to then fail. And so there were times where I was not aware, but others where you truly could feel that vacillation happening.
I'm wondering, two things occur to me. So one is if Silicon Valley, the TV show, is any is any example. I find it to be very accurate, by the way. But it's sort of compressed. You know, time frames are kind of compressed. But it seems very accurate to me. And if to that degree that it is accurate, any vulnerability is discouraged in the culture of tech, which is weirdly how the blood chick got in trouble. What's her name?
Elizabeth Holmes.
Elizabeth Holmes got in trouble, right? She could never, ever talk about any questions about the product. To me, that's where she really sunk herself. And that's contrary, which is really interesting, contrary to essentially all science, but particularly the life sciences. So weirdly, sort of to the extent that tech is a science, it has diverged from I don't know how biotech operates that well, but I'm imagining it's full of life sciences people that think everything is just sort of maybe. Everything's a maybe.
Absolutely. And listen, like what happened with Theranos is not a terribly unique story. Hers just became obviously one of the most public and one of the most, you know, significant legally. But that complex of show everyone, yourself, investors, you know, employees, clients, what they need to see in order to succeed. Yeah. And we will figure out all the lies later. That is a common attitude in the tech startup game. And we're somewhat encouraged to do it as well. Clearly not to a felonious level that she did, but the basic mindset of fake it till you make it is par for the course. That is what we're instructed to do as entrepreneurs and rewarded for doing.
And so did that really help solidify the imposter stuff for you? Was that something that was going on at the same time?
Absolutely.
So that was also
going
on at the same
time.
They're
all part and parcel. Yeah.
I can see how people would feel like an imposter if they are being an imposter.
Absolutely.
And they're psychologically set up for it too.
Absolutely. When I started the company, I would go around and tell everyone who asked, I am creating the best design company in Chicago. That was my pitch. That meant nothing. I'm not even a designer.
Yeah.
What? I was a 26-year-old kid in debt who had, you know, basically failed college. Why would that claim even have the littlest bit of credibility? Because I was saying it with confidence. That's it.
When was that? What year was that?
10 years ago, 2010.
So I was in the middle of all this stuff in 1999 when it had a different version of it. That was sort of the website area. Have I ever told you the story, Gary?
Oh, Adam talks about it all the time, how DrDrew.com was valued at $50 million.
Well, it's got even weirder. So here's what happened. So a friend of mine went to Harvard Business School, and we went to college together and high school together and junior high school together. And he goes, hey, man, you ever thought about doing a website? I mean, he's back east now. I go, I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, let's just come with me. Let's go. So we went up to Sand Hill Road. He goes, just follow my lead. I had no idea what he was talking about. And we sat there in a SoftBank funded VC, venture capital. And he sort of gave a pitch. I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. I get what he's talking about. And the pitch was 10 minutes. The group that we pitched to, I said almost nothing. I just reiterated what he said because it sounded good to me. The group in the room convened in another room for about 5 minutes, and they came back and gave us $5 million or $10 million. It was $10 million.
Wow.
I mean, it was insanity. At that point, had an angel investor involved that had given us $1 million. And so he was starting to put things together and stuff with that $1 million. I still didn't really understand until I heard his pitch on Sand Hill Road what it was we were doing. So I was like, okay, I'm in. We'll go build this company.
Wait, for the listeners, what were you doing? What was his pitch?
His pitch was Drew's a trusted DrDrew.com is going to be the trusted destiny. We were going to be the MTV of the internet, essentially. And at that time, Adam and I were on MTV and stuff, and sort of we trusted brand on MTV will be a trusted brand on the internet, right? And they were desperate to send money out to try to find. So essentially, they were looking for the next Amazon, next.
That was the peak of that first .com bubble.
First bubble, and so right, exactly. What emerged from it was Amazon, Google, and what else emerged from that? What do you guys think else?
Yahoo, I mean, at
Microsoft,
the time.
Yahoo, all that. Yeah, Yahoo, yeah,
MSN, a few websites. Yeah, yeah. You know, sort of the websites you open your page to. That when you open your computer and those, here's your choices, which is Google and Apple and Amazon,
AOL, yeah.
AOL, all these things emerged from that whole dash. It was a dash. It was literally. It reminded me of when the U.S. government opened the frontier along the Oklahoma border. People just ran in and started putting down flags and things. And so my buddy put together a board of directors. And I'm sorry, John, for going all the way off on this, but I realized
– No, let's keep going. This is interesting.
No one's ever really heard me tell this story. And Gary, particularly, you need to know it, so you'll be armed when Adam talks about it, because Adam only got the flavor of it because he was around when it was going on. So he put a board together with people that had found the road to liquidity, which is the language I understood, which is essentially, you know, built a website for a nickel and sold it for $100 million. And these were all people from San Jose, and they came in, and we had this board. None of these people did I know. None of these websites had I ever heard of. Some of them became like search engines, PayPal, things like, you know, things. Elon Musk is another great example of having done it, made it. PayPal was, boom, one of those things that made it. And we were building essentially a magazine online, essentially. And I kept saying, why do we need another phone book that you can just get on your computer? Why do we need – this is – I don't understand what we're doing. This is a phone book. This is just a and I thought, well, what's unique is that we have these chat rooms, and that's kind of interesting. If we learn to build those chat rooms into something interactive, if I'd fucking gone one step further, I would have thought of social media. And then I kept saying, we need video. We need video, and we ended up doing a TV show every week, like formally produced television show every week with the guests where everybody came on. Everybody, all our MTV guests came on this little video thing because it was kind of a cool thing to do to be on the internet. The problem was nobody could see it. Nobody could watch it because nobody had broadband, if you remember that whole transition. So if I'd thought one step further, I could have invented social media and YouTube because I was onto both things. And my team was just interested in publishing a phone book, essentially. And I just kept saying, why? What would it mean? So I go into the first board meeting and I go, look, they want to hear from me. And I go, you know, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what we're doing here. And we're spending lots of money, and we have no idea how to make this a profitable thing. So I'm kind of thinking we got to figure out a way to kind of keep it where it is and figure out some way of being profitable and then growing from there. And this one guy, one of my board members, screamed at me and pounded his fist, and he said, if I thought you were so stupid, I never would have gotten involved in this company. And he gets up, and there was a huge dry erase board on the other side of the room, and he gets up and he goes, this is how you make money on the internet. And he writes in – guy's hypomanic as hell – and he writes in giant letters, get big fast. And then the whole concept of burning, monthly burn, came into my consciousness. And we went down that path, and that's where we went. And the idea was to build essentially audience fast. That's really what they wanted, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea of profitability, anathema. No, forget profitability. Don't worry about that.
Well, keep in mind, Drew, this hasn't changed in 20 years. This is still Silicon Valley.
Insane.
This is still it, man.
That's insane because that's not a business. That's a, I don't know, enterprise. I don't know what it is. Not a business has to make money. So mind you, we had great success getting big fast and went so much so that there we were on March 19th, 1999, sitting in Goldman fucking Sachs with a woman across the table from us telling us giving us a $110 million valuation on a company that did nothing and was going to contemplate give us $20 million. Except that particular day was the day the NASDAQ crashed completely.
Wow.
It evaporated. And she looks at us and she goes, let's kind of see how this day plays out before we make a decision about that $20 million. And my buddy and I were in Times Square. You know that big NASDAQ where ABC is? Looking in the window at the NASDAQ graph there in Times Square, just watching this just – what would you call it? A bullet in the wrong direction. Just this absolute, absolute catastrophe involving in front of our eyes. And we're like, oh my God. And that's immediately following that is when this was a great education for me. It was the most, I mean, it was expensive for a lot of people, but it was a business school education for me on how to seed, fund, build a business. And then I learned that immediately when we returned back to Pasadena, the next phase of the business cycle, downsize, liquidate, eliminate, you know, close up shop. And that was incredible to see the full cycle of a business inside of a year. It was the weirdest damn thing I've ever experienced. But so, John, I kind of know the territory in which you've been. And I learned a ton of what I would do differently and, you know, and what this is all about. So, Gary, any questions about this? Really, I'm telling this for Gary's benefit since he's been around us talking about this forever. I've never told the whole story.
No, it's super interesting. Yeah. I mean, Adam always talks about how Adam just can't wrap his head around the tech format. You know, he's such a
Adam, he does podcasting for a living.
Listen, I get it. And John, just in case you're not aware, we've been referring to Adam Carolla, Drew's partner, Loveline forever.
Yeah.
You know, he's podcasting. I think he understands a little bit, but he's got a unique understanding of that because he
thinks it's radio. He thinks it's radio online.
He wants it to be radio online because that's what he's comfortable with. You know, from a business standpoint, you know, he's been physically, tangibly building things with his hands for so long that the idea that DrDrew.com is worth more than $20 just doesn't compute to him.
It shouldn't have been.
He can't
He's
understand
right.
it.
He's right. Absolutely correct.
I 100% agree.
What's interesting to me is that he still looks for salaries in his podcasting kind of business, which is interesting because that's a radio head. That's a radio thing.
Yeah, well, it's you know, and I can sort of understand it.
I do too. Listen, we got salaries on radio. It was life-changing. Jesus Christ. I mean, going from
– Adam's literally a millionaire.
Struggling from 5 in the morning till 10 at night taking care of critically ill patients. And then running a drug unit. This is a salary from a radio station.
Crazy,
crazy. Yeah,
talk
crazy.
For a living?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, what the hell? So, John, I'll hand it back to you. I'm sorry for that digression.
No, that's a super interesting story,
isn't
actually.
It?
I mean, that was a bit before my time, but I read a lot about that generation. It's fucking insane what happened back then.
It's insane. So give me a story in your own generational version of this that sort of mirrors my ancient history.
The biggest part is that, you know, I started this company again with not a lot of foundation, and it starts to work to the level that we become one of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. And unlike the story you told, we were a real business. We were profitable from day zero.
What? What's wrong with you? Just get big. Don't
insane,
worry about the business.
Right? I know. Insane, right?
And your board members must have been pissed.
No board, no partners, no investors, no nothing.
So you were just a privately held. Did you have any VC money or anything? Or
company.
Was there VC money involved?
Never a dollar this company.
So there's no private equity or anything?
Nothing.
Okay.
So my net investment, Drew, in this company was $800.
Wow. Gary.
John, what was you don't have to give the name if you don't want, but what did your company do?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So it's in the book. So this is all, you know, pretty public at this point.
Yeah.
The company is called Okta, and we were a design and innovation consultancy. So basically, we were called upon by pretty big, prestigious companies to design, innovate products for them. And so somebody would say, we have an idea or a challenge or a problem, and they wanted us to go through the theoreticals, to go through a business, you know, case, and then design a digital solution for whatever their idea was. And so that could have been, you know, products we did for BMW cars, products we did for United Airlines planes. I mean, we did some pretty wild stuff towards the end. But at the beginning, it was because I had a small glimpse into design kind of when I was in California at another failed startup. And when I came back to Chicago, I was like, wow, no one knows a fucking thing about design in Chicago. I know almost nothing, but a little bit more than them. Therefore, I believe I can sell them something. And that's all it was.
Well, but that to me seems like a legitimate position to take in the sense your job then just is hiring the right people.
Well, that was it. And so I believed in the philosophy of design, despite not being able to do it myself. But I did believe that if somebody said yes to me, I could then find the people who actually knew how to do
that
it
makes sense
build a business.
That makes sense.
It made sense. But it felt a little bit fraudulent to go out, you know, because normally you'd expect a lawyer to start a law firm or a doctor to start a doctor's office. You don't expect a non-designer to start a design firm. So it felt a little strange, but listen, it worked. And so our first client was a $300,000 account, and which was a hell of a way to start, became very real very fast. And 2 years later, in 2012, 2012, I think it was, end of the year, we were one of the 500 fastest growing private companies in America, all bootstrapped, never took a dollar in capital.
Wow.
And so to your point, Drew, about kind of getting your business education very quickly, I got it real quick.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know any of this stuff.
But that's the
and
stuff
I had nobody assist.
That's what they study in Harvard Business School. That's what they study.
And I had nobody assisting.
Yeah.
I didn't have a board. I didn't have mentors. I didn't have anybody.
Crazy.
So I had to learn very quickly. But the craziest part was 2 years later when we decided to sell the company. Now we're a big company. We're considering global expansion. We're just printing fucking money. And that's when I had my mental break. And I ended up in a hospital after crashing out really, really hard. And it was after that that I realized that if I didn't finish this journey soon, I probably wasn't going to survive it. And so I then had to figure out how to sell a company in a 9-month process, which was the most insane and challenging business process I've ever been through. And our banker said, he's like, you just learned, you know, you just basically got your MBA, you know, in about 6 months. And it was a hell of a thing. And we got lucky to, you know, have sold the company outright to Salesforce in 2015.
All right. So I want to get into all that. But before we I want to just make a couple of points and clarify a couple of things.
Yeah.
One is, while I think it's legitimate for you to have been in the position you were in without a big design background, the Theranos story is a very telling to me, the tale is about the risks of not knowing about biology if you're going to be in the tech biological tech business, because you have to understand biology. You must understand how nefarious and vague and probabilistic and uncertain it is. And so she did not know any of that, clearly, in my mind.
But I'll tell you something, Drew, because I talk about Theranos quite a bit with people.
Yeah.
And when the story really broke, I had a different opinion than a lot, because what she ultimately was doing was attempting to build something that you're completely right. It was not her wheelhouse. She did not understand. But like me, she figured with enough time, people, and money, we can figure it out.
But hold on, Gary, the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering. I find this story fascinating and know a lot about it. Should we give a thumbnail sketch
go
for
ahead.
People who
go
don't?
Ahead.
So I'm not John. If you feel comfortable,
no, give it to us.
Just basically
rock out, man. Rock out.
He's into it.
Yeah, it's this is a lady who built this whole business on the idea that she could create a blood test that could do all kinds of crazy bullshit that just isn't physically possible. She dressed like Steve Jobs.
Single drop of blood.
Right. Yeah. Single drop of blood. She modeled after Steve Jobs. She gave these sweeping presentations. She was a very eloquent speaker. And she basically just built this shell game around something that any doctor would look at and go, well, how the hell is that going to be possible?
Forget how the hell is that going to be possible. If you watch the documentary, there was a female physician about my age who said something, the only thing in the whole thing that to me I went, yeah, that's exactly how I feel, which is it's completely unnecessary. We don't need this.
Right.
They were not going to add any diagnostics. Who cares if you take a test tube of blood or a drop? Who gives a shit? All we need is the accurate information. Oh,
well,
you can do a finger stick as opposed to a blood draw? Who cares? Really,
Drew, you just nailed it. That's exactly it. And this is what people I don't think understand, because the vibe you get when people watch documentaries, oh, she's a sociopath.
Yeah.
Oh, she's this like psychopath, emotionless robot
who's
defrauding people. That's not true at all. What she did was not dissimilar to what other entrepreneurs have done. She just, again, towed that line into the felonious territory.
Yeah.
But when Elon Musk did Tesla, and he said by, you know, whatever year he said, that was insane, where he's like, we won't be driving cars anymore. It'll be like robots. You can have a nap in the back seat. That's insane. That was impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, not just technologically, but societally. That was never going to work inside of our roads, our cities, et cetera. But that's what got people excited. That's how he raised money. That's how he built the brand. That's how he built his empire. And then he slimmed the vision down to something amazing, but very doable.
Yeah.
That's what she was trying to do.
It's like if Elon Musk said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to invent the automobile. It'll just be a little smaller. Maybe a little more efficient, and maybe you'll be able to have it in your living room instead of your garage, but I want the automobile. The automobile is going to be great. It's like, I don't need that. I don't need it.
Right. And listen, I mean, clearly she got enough people excited about the vision. And I think what she was attempting to do, and without knowing her, this is my thesis on it, is that she was trying to have enough roadmap and enough roadway in order to achieve a version of her vision before the money ran out. You know, with the momentum that she had created.
Yeah, I get
now,
that. I get that.
Obviously, you know, stepping over the line into, you know, illegalities is a whole different, you know, ball of wax. But that mentality of pitch the impossible, this is the Steve Jobs mentality.
Yeah.
He would go to developers inside Apple and demand of them something he knew was impossible.
Yeah.
to get them to work as hard as possible. I mean, he knew that it was literally fucking possible for them to deliver what he asked for, but that's how he got them done.
But in electronic, in technology and electronics engineering, impossible is a relative term. In life sciences, there's impossible.
Oh, trust me, I'm not defending it. Oh, I am in no way defending Elizabeth. I am only trying to provide what might be a different perspective instead of just
and to be fair,
it
just
crazy.
Yeah, I too I couldn't tell what was going on with her. She is a little odd and whatever. Right, right. But the reality is just a bad business, just a bad idea, and you get right down to it. But so the other thing we've been using terms that I just want to clarify for people. So you know, a solo. What would you call what would you call your company as a solo owner?
We call it bootstrap, right? Okay. So when you don't raise capital and you're solo, it's a bootstrap,
right? Company. So as opposed to venture capital, which are people with these funds with a lot of money that want to put money into your business, like Shark Tank. Shark Tank is essentially venture capital, and their desire is to get out as fast as possible with as much money as possible. So they're always looking to dump you off somewhere, but it leaves it in the hands of guys like John or me. If we're taking the venture capital, we're stuck in this thing for a long time while the venture capital goes, have a good time, double their money, and they just leave, right?
It does happen that way. But a lot of times you see them doubling down and doubling down to the point where the founder ends up with almost nothing.
Loses. Well, that's a different – right. You and that
which
I seems
a,
to me
– super common story these days, man.
Yeah. It seems to me that's also – something happens on the private equity side, which is, again, you have other kinds of funds that are owned by individuals rather than organizations and or a one person, and that one person's investing in your company, that kind of thing. So it's a whole different kind of vibe. So let's now go to your your crashing out episode. So walk me through that. And when that's a nice euphemism, but what actually happened?
Yeah. So into our fourth year, and it was interesting because I was living between two worlds perfectly. And so one world was, you know, this young CEO that was doing TED Talks and speeches and making millions of dollars. And I was the quintessential tech entrepreneur. As soon as no one was looking, I was, you know, basically a mess of a human. I was partying, doing drugs, you know, I was basically in Vegas every other weekend, you know, blowing tens of thousands of dollars and just living this insane life. And it was all to try to avoid my situation. It was all an effort to numb myself and to not think about what I was doing during the day, because it scared the hell out of me, the risk I was taking, et cetera. So all of that built up a lot. And I got to a point where, you know, it was just your traditional, I would say, self-destructive patterns. And it was happening more and more and more. Work was getting more and more stressful. And I came home after a pretty serious Vegas bender weekend and, of course, went straight back to a party in Chicago and lost consciousness, completely blacked out. And
but were you unconscious or blacked out? Two different things.
So I blacked out.
So you were running around doing stuff. You were running around doing stuff, but you just didn't remember.
I was in the middle of a conversation, and the girl, this is all I heard the story later. I just started mumbling, and I thought I was speaking perfectly clearly. And she's like, I can't understand you. You're mumbling. And the lights go out for me, and I woke up 3 days later at Northwestern Hospital. Mm-hmm. And I had, from what I understand, and I'd love your, you know, obviously your analysis of this, but had suffered a psychotic break that led to dissociative amnesia. And so
it's a little fancy way of describing it. What were the drugs you were using at the time? Alcohol, number one.
Well, there was the prescription side. So, you know, a lot of benzos and those kinds of things to get through the day. And then on the other side, there was alcohol, there was cocaine, there was party drugs.
So you were encephalopathic. Your brain wasn't working right. Who knows what was going on? You had psychotic features, meaning you were probably delusional and agitated and grandiose and who knows what else. And you were in a blackout. Now, dissociative blackout,
reason that they said that is because apparently I was answering questions in those 3 days before I regained consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
They were saying to me, what's your name? What city are you in? I didn't have a clue. Couldn't unlock my phone. Didn't know my own password.
But that's the difference between an encephalopathy and a psychosis. A psychotic person will say, I'm Napoleon. It's July 21st, 2020. You know, they will know exactly where they are. They'll know exactly what's going on. Well, I mean, what's going on.
Okay.
But they're fully oriented. As soon as you go into disorientation, now you're going towards global brain dysfunction and encephalopathy. So organic brain stuff. All right. Very so you cool. were you were disoriented. And someone and to say see because dissociated is a sort of a psychological thing, and I want to disabuse you of that if we can, because you were okay, you were yeah. you were in a brain state, and the because you were using so much stuff. There's no way to know if that was withdrawal or intoxication or some mixed state, right. You know, who or a manic state with a withdrawal. Yeah, who knows? It's just
it's just
all over the place. But the fact that you were disoriented puts it in the organic category.
Okay. Yeah. So it was a few days later that I even knew up from down and knew who I was again. And there's only one human being who knew I was there, who was my kind of number two at the company, a guy named Kevin. And Kevin you know, came to get me, and I kept it from everybody, every employee, my own parents, you know, my friends. I didn't tell anybody, but it was the wake up call. It was the, my body and mind screaming at me, you better stop this or else this isn't going to end well. And so that's what led to, you know, hiring an investment bank and seeking a sale of the company. And we were very fortunate to do that 9 months later, but it was the scariest week of my life. You know, Doc, I can't even explain. It was the scariest week of my entire life.
Right. Now, what's interesting clinically about your whole thing is that there's no way to tell from the story as you've described it whether we have different ways of defining these things these days. You clearly had a substance use disorder, but I sort of divide into a use disorder versus an addiction. And I can't tell if you're a drug addict from that story. You were just using a lot of drugs. You don't seem like a drug addict. You don't strike me as a drug addict.
Well, and this is what's interesting is that, you know, I'd like to hear from you, like how we always use the term addictive personality, if that's actually a thing, because I haven't felt like I've ever had that. I used to smoke cigarettes. One day I decided I don't want cigarettes anymore. I haven't had them since. I don't do drugs anymore. And it seemed like it was very.
Drug addicts don't stop doing drugs. They don't just stop. You don't change the environment and the drug addict stop. A non-drug addict.
I was drawn to anything.
Yeah.
To turn my brain off, to stop the chaos in my brain. Yeah. And so, you know, it didn't matter what it was. Drugs just so happened to be one of the fastest and easiest methods. But there was the partying, there was the sex, there was the excess. It was all of the things that could just stop the situation for a period of time.
I will tell you that sex addiction sometimes is right in the middle of that kind of stuff. So there may be a little bit of that business going on there. But mostly it sounds like you were bipolar. You're sort of manic, and it was spiraling, and you were using medication to try to manage it.
Yeah, because I mean, my situation day to day scared the hell out of me, because it felt like, and it was true, because my entire worth, not just financially, but my entire sense of self, my financial worth, even my future was all in one company that could have failed at really any time. Businesses can come and go. Yeah. And so you sit up at night and you think about that if I get the wrong phone call tomorrow or two things happen, you know, concurrently, I lose everything, maybe forever. And I'm now bankrupt and fighting that till I'm 60.
Yeah.
Those things are scary, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a high. That's wire. What you're, I was running
you're,
from.
You're literally on the high wire. You're literally you're just up on a wire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what's another thing that's interesting to me too is do you have to take medication now or are you not?
No.
Yeah.
No,
see, that's interesting to me. So it's sort of situationally driven, all this stuff, which is fascinating. Okay.
Well, I got into a lot of work at the end, you know, Doc. I was with a doctor in Chicago who helped me out. We did a lot of neurofeedback, biofeedback, all sorts of stuff to kind of repair body and mind after that.
Well, good. I mean, because the story sounds like somebody that ended up on medication, and the fact that you're not and you have no symptoms now and everything, that's tremendous.
Yeah.
In fact, you might want to. Do you want to give me who did that? Maybe we can. People are looking for that kind of treatment.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a guy named Alex Pazitopoulos, a Greek guy in Chicago. He's one of the smartest. He's become a good friend. He's a very smart guy, and he introduced me to just a different way of caring for myself that I had never considered, and it was really 360, and it was everything from. The more, I would say, baseline medical procedures to some things that I never knew existed, like neurofeedback. And those were all incredibly helpful.
Yeah, neurobiofeedback is a really interesting phenomenon. We just listening to clicks in your ears and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you kind of wear all these leads attached to your head, a little helmet thing. You're basically playing a brain video game on a
screen.
That's
right. It's exactly what you do.
You're figuring all these brain waves can change things on a screen, and it's pretty wild.
Yeah, people think – let me sort of drill into that a little bit, because people think, oh, you learn to meditate. No, not meditate. Oh, you learn to understand. Nope. You literally are getting – through the visual and the biofeedback, you learn to access parts of your brain that are non-rational, non-conscious, not accessible, not understandable, and regulate them
through
these feedback. Yeah,
I've been put through these really intense stress tests and what are QEEG tests, if that sounds right.
Yeah, yeah.
And they basically were like, you know, your executive functions are firing like redlined even when you're trying to relax.
Yeah.
Your limbic system's basically not working. And
right,
so,
right.
you know, that was to start to reinvigorate these parts of your brain to slow others down.
Right.
And it was you know, and I worked on that for, you know, 6 or 9 months straight.
Did you do any psychology or insight oriented stuff as well? Or was it all just brain stuff?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah. I got into multiple forms of therapy and to this day, I'm still, you know, quite, you know, I love my therapy and my therapist.
And so, what's been helpful? How would you characterize what's been helpful on the psychotherapeutic side?
You know, I would say it's really just coming to terms with things in a real-time basis instead of just retrospectively. It was one thing to look back at the journey to write the book and to try to figure out later what happened.
Yeah.
It's another thing to wake up with a feeling and be able to go into a, you know, sit with somebody and say, right now I'm feeling this. What does that mean?
It's so funny. In my therapy, that was really important too.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I didn't understand for like a couple of years that I was supposed to walk in the room and go, okay, here's what I'm feeling. Because I didn't have access to feelings earlier in my therapy. And once you get access to your feelings, it's like, oh, okay. And then let me articulate this a little further. Then the therapist's job is to hold you in a frame where it's safe to explore those feelings and to reflect back to you, maybe not in any kind of way at all other than through their body attuning to you a regulated version of what you're feeling.
That makes sense? Really interesting because I think it starts to explain why we have these feelings in the first place, right? There's got to be a reason for them. And so as soon as you learn, you can process those and someone can assist in that. It's really interesting.
Right. And oftentimes someone can assist in that part is stuff we miss during childhood. And that's what's supposed to happen in parenting, but it's really hard to do that properly.
You know, 100%,
almost nobody does. Do you have kids?
I don't know, but I've a niece now and a nephew on the way. So, you know, been around more of a, you know, kids in the family. And, you know, I find it fascinating. I really do, you know, enjoy kind of the psychology of the parenting because I think about it, you know, how I'll be in the future. And it sounds tough.
And so without, you know, sort of pointing fingers and, you know, sort of vilifying anybody, what do you think was lacking in your childhood that sort of set you up for all this?
Well, I think it's, you know, first of all, I was the kind of I was the outcast of the family in some way. Not necessarily, that's the wrong word. No, it's not the outcast. I was the black sheep in some
scapegoat.
Ways.
You were the scapegoat.
Yeah, a little bit because, you know, my brain's attuned differently. There's no entrepreneurship anywhere in my extended family. I mean, my dad, again, was an immigrant and he became an engineer and went to, you know, worked at Chrysler's entire life.
Yeah.
My mom was a nurse and a teacher. Mm. And not even in the extended family. We had doctors. We had, you know, other things.
Yeah.
So I was a bit odd. And I when I came to my own as a teenager, I started to rebel. I started to say, like, why should I go do something I don't want to do there's things I do want to do over here.
Yeah.
And no one understood that. And no one supported it. But they wanted to. They wanted to support me. They just had no clue that was, you know, maybe okay, maybe something we could take advantage of. And so I ended up as a loner. I ended up doing everything on my own because I didn't think there was a single human being in the world that could relate to me. And again, I don't blame my parents at all for that because how would you have known at that point?
Well, there's a really interesting there's a sociological piece to your family story too, which is the immigrant story, which is this is a classic immigrant story, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's supposed to be a doctor and a lawyer and success to the kids really important and the parents are hard driving but emotionally absent and maybe even physically abusive because they bring some of that from the old country and, you know, and there it is.
Yeah.
That sets it all up.
Yeah, Dad was the traditional kind of Latin American patriarch, and he also is extremely intelligent, held multiple master's degrees. And so to him, to see his son almost fail high school was a catastrophe, you know, and that,
Harry
that is a life of – that's a life of nothing right there.
It is a second generation story, immigrant story. Your whole family's thing is just sort of characteristic. So what – let's go back to now the selling of the company. What did you – you know, that education, what did you walk away with you could share with other people that might be meaningful to somebody?
I mean, it was the most difficult – I mean, it was interesting from an academic standpoint because I'd never experienced kind of high-level business. Mm-hmm. The whole time you're running what was still a reasonably small business when you compare it to large companies. And then all of a sudden – and here's what's funny, Doc, is we used to – you know, before I started Okta, I was trying to get a job. I was trying to be a productive member of society. And so I knew technology well enough. I could sell the hell out of whatever I wanted to. So I tried to interview at Google and Microsoft and Salesforce and all these companies. I didn't get past a phone screening, a single one of them. And now 5 years later, I'm sitting in these boardrooms with the CEOs of all these companies discussing
weird.
A sale to them. It was the strangest feeling I can describe. But ultimately, you know, you now realize that you have something that's very valuable and you have to figure out how to monetize it. But the dynamics of a sale, we usually get those in headlines. So-and-so sold X to Y for X millions. That's all we read. And it's like, oh, that must be nice.
Yeah.
The level of complexity and the level of risk and how kind of messy these deals actually are is haunting.
And there's two sides, right? There's the investment banking side, and then there's the lawyering and the lawyering side.
Yeah.
Two different sort of things.
And that's once you get even to a fundamental deal. The process of trying to sell that and all the gamesmanship behind that. And then figure out, and again, I'm in my 20s. You know, like, I guess at that point, I just turned 30. So, but I, you know, most of the adventure, I was in my 20s. And so it's not like there's a wealth of just adult experience to fall back on or colleagues who have gone through this before. And so you're learning all this in real time, but you're expected to know it, right? So they're not looking at you and saying, oh, you're only 30. You shouldn't know what, you know, blah, blah, blah is. You should know all of this, even though there's no fundamental reason I actually should.
And this is back to the Theranos model. You're hiding what you don't know.
Absolutely.
No showing weakness of the
other
side
just,
of the table.
And just praying that you're not asked that one question that you look like an absolute idiot.
Don't the IB guys and the lawyers kind of protect you?
They do. They do. Yeah. But at the end of the day, they're speaking to you. Right? Yeah. It's not a courtroom. Right? They're not letting your representative speak for you. You're the CEO.
Wow.
So they're speaking to you. And so, and we weren't playing games. We talked to the biggest of the big companies. And again, our acquirer, Salesforce, who's one of the best tech companies of our generation, is who acquired us. And these guys are so intelligent. You just feel dumb in the room.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh crap.
Yeah.
I am so outmatched here.
Yeah.
And, but you got to win and you got to fight. And that was a crazy game. I think I took 150 flights in 170 days.
Oh, Jesus.
It was something around that number. And then,
and you were recovering too from all the,
and I was recovering.
Drugs.
Oh. Yeah. And I was off the drugs and the drinking and the partying and the sex. And
yeah.
You have a lot more time to exist inside your own head, which is not a fun place to be at that point in time. And the traveling doesn't help. You're just constantly in flux and you don't even know what city you're in half the time. You're just repeating the same spiel, trying to keep it all together. And what's the weirdest part was we get to a deal and it's for an extraordinary amount of money that I couldn't even fathom. You know, again, I never understood having money. It was a very new concept. And so you fundamentally make this deal and you start signing papers as if like that. It just seems like the silliest thing. It's little pieces of paper that are about to change everything. And then one day it just ends. You get on a conference call and everyone goes, are we good? Hey, you know, lawyers that side, everyone good? Good. You're good. Okay, cool. And the phone goes silent. And then you're like, what the fuck? It's over? And
that's it.
And the crazy part for me, and have you seen the HBO documentary, The Weight of Gold, the new one?
No.
Ooh. Oh my God. Please go watch it. It is absolutely brilliant. And doctor, you're going to love it. But it's about Olympians and what their psychological turmoil sometimes
really,
post
really good.
Yeah,
winning.
I bet.
Oh, it is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I sell the company. I'm done. I'm good. I can do whatever I want. My life has changed. I could, retire. I am done. And all of my shit just came dumping on me. I fell into my worst depression, my worst level of anxiety, my worst physical point and mental point after the sale.
That makes sense.
Everything just came crashing.
It's kind of what happens like when people are dealing with somebody who's ill and then they die. And then after they're fine taking care of them. But then afterward, it's all stops. That's when the moods and everything kind of crash in.
Yeah. Because when you're that busy, it was easy to pretend it didn't exist and to dance around it and to find ways. Once it wasn't there anymore, holy crap.
You know, it's always kind of fascinated me. And this is going to sound completely ridiculous, but the next day does some numbers appear in your account? How's that happen? Is all of a sudden there's a bunch of zeros in your account? Is it in your bank account or do you set up a fund somewhere? What is that?
I love
how's
you
that
said
work?
That because I asked the same thing. I'm calling my accountants being like, so I signed some papers and we shake some hands, but what happened?
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
Trust me, I had the same question because we never think about that. And I'll tell you, so I knew what day the I was supposed to get paid. Yeah. And to your point, like, you know, you wonder if it's some like big fancy something, you know, some dude with a briefcase comes up. You
type it right. Keypad, like, or just what is what it? Actually, or is it something happens over a long period of time? I guess it depends on the deal. But you know, but anyway, well,
what happened with me is I was sitting at lunch with a buddy and I knew that day I was supposed to be paid. And this sounds so stupid to admit. I'm sitting there on my cell phone with my Chase checking account open.
Yes.
Refreshing it. I'm always like pulling
that makes
it down.
Perfect sense to me. Like, what's going to happen
him
here?
And I are talking. Yeah. As like, we're just in the whole lunch, I'm just every, you know, few seconds, I'm refreshing it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, in my literal checking account, like where you buy coffee from, is a new number. And it, and the first thing I did, which I'm not sure I've ever admitted this, I transferred $1 million from my checking account to my savings account just to see if it would work. Just to like, just to like,
to see if it's real.
Yeah. I was like, I wonder if that will even, and it was one of the strangest.
That makes, that makes perfect sense to me. Cause all that to me seems like so like magical, like Penn and Teller.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
That's exactly it. It was very strange.
That is insane. Did you, could you manage the money at that point? Or cause you, now you'd been a CEO and so you'd manage budgets and things and you kind of knew the flow of capital. Did that reflect into your personal life or did you blow it?
Well, thankfully, I had made bits of money in the years leading up to that. So basically, I became an official millionaire my last day of being 29. Wow. And what's strange is that I had set a stretch goal to become a millionaire by 30.
Yeah.
And it actually happened the day before.
What do you got planned now? I'll keep an eye on you because you're pretty good at predicting things. What's your next goal?
I'll send you some option calls and we can But you know, it was crazy because it actually happened. And so I had a bit of money for about a year before the sale. And thankfully, once you make a bit of money and it becomes more public, like, you know, bankers just come out of the woodwork. And thankfully, I had some amazing guys I got introduced to in Chicago who had worked with a lot of tech entrepreneurs. And so I had already been putting my money with them before I sold the
company.
Got it.
By the way, it makes me wonder about Chase, too. Did Chase, like, call you when that money showed up in their account? Like, Mr. Rowe?
Yeah, exactly. we had told them beforehand. Thankfully.
Okay, got it.
But I think checking accounts, the insurance is like,
oh my God,
in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So trust me, we had to get it out of there.
Yeah, all insured money. Anyway, so you knew how to manage stuff. That's good. So you didn't go crazy.
Yeah, but ultimately, there's a couple investment bankers who I'd formed a relationship with. So I basically gave it all to them. And I was like, I trust you to kind of do the right thing. Obviously, I had oversight on it to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't keep it inside my own control for very long.
But geez, handing it over to somebody, oof, that's scary too. But
it was scary, yeah. And you do hear horror stories on this, but I felt like I had done a pretty good, diligence on that. It was one of the major banks. And then I've made some investments. I've made, dozens of angel investments. I built a home in Greece. And so I put my money to work, ultimately I let the professionals deal with that.
And did you say you were focused on $1 million by the time you're 30? That was your goal? A millionaire by 30?
That was the goal, being a millionaire by 30. Yeah.
How did you focus your mind on that? Did you just, was it a thought or something you wrote down or because I wouldn't have given that much meaning, but I've recently been thinking about this and I think there are techniques to focus your mind to keep goals ahead of you that probably do work a little bit. I'm just wondering if you used anything like that.
I didn't use anything literal.
Yeah.
And when I made that goal, I was very young, I think maybe even like high school. Yeah. And so it was one of those things where it's like, what's the most ridiculous goal I can think to make? And it was being a millionaire by 30.
But I think some people can do stuff like that. Have you had it since then? Have been other things you've decided to do that little out there and you did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right that subconsciously that was probably, I was, listen, it literally happened the day before 30. So that means I had to have been proactively, generating
some
this
part
to
of you with your, some part of your brain
absolutely.
Was focused on that goal. So what, give me another example of something you've done that's out there and made it.
Well, I'll use an example of what I just mentioned in Greece. And so after I kind of went through my medical stuff, I resigned from Salesforce. I moved to Europe and I said, I'm going to live out basically a dream and I'm going to build a home in Mykonos, Greece. And I'm going to live here in the summers and London in the winters. And I'm going to not do tech or business. And I'm going to enjoy the hell out of my life in my early 30s. And, this project in Greece goes without a doubt saying high risk, pretty wild to do, pretty insane. I'm not in real estate. I'm not in development, to go build what I did and then to make it work enough where you can have a return and sell the asset and make that into, a credible investment in a period of time that I had set out, and all that worked out.
Good. Okay. So that kind of thing. So, but they're a little more, little less seemingly out there goals. The goals that it's still big risk. But
Because that was more of like a, you know, kind of a financial one. Others from a life perspective are what I said to myself was kind of after that period of time, it was then time to move on, and it was time to go back to real life, and it was time to, you know, to stop that period of my life. And so last year, a year ago, I wrote the book, got that book deal done with Penguin Random House, which was, you know, that was surprising. But that was also a goal. I said, I'm going to do this with a major publisher, got that done, got the podcast with iHeart, moved to New York, living in Manhattan. And I'm now in a much more kind of routine, you know, and relatively speaking, kind of chilled out life, focusing on my cool projects. And that was a goal I'd set many years ago too.
Are you in Manhattan now?
I am. Yeah.
What part of town?
I'm in Soho.
So one of these days I'm come down and visit you. I'm there a lot. And
definitely do. And, it's so nice down here right now.
It's crazy. I was there a couple weeks ago, and it was like, I keep telling everybody, it's like visiting Machu Picchu. You know, there's this great civilization, and suddenly everybody left. and so we're not far from the meatpacking, so we walk over the meatpacking, and it's like you walk into any restaurant. It's like, this is ridiculous. Very weird. But
downtown's been super fun, because obviously we did a pretty good job of the virus here. And so New York's numbers have been quite low in the last 6 weeks.
Ridiculously low. Yeah.
So there's no. And so the city's been fantastic.
Yeah. All right, my friend. It's been really a pleasure to get to meet you and hear your story. And I hope people will be intrigued and get a practical way to get rich and die trying. Lots of, my goodness, wonderful. Jordan Harbinger's in here on the back of your.
Yeah, I know you know Jordan.
Yeah. Jordan's a great
guy. Good buddy of mine.
Well, maybe the three of us will get together, because I don't spend enough time with Jordan. So.
That'd be awesome.
All right. Well, listen, John, thank you for joining us. And again, the podcast is The John Roa Show. Where can they get it?
On iHeart, everywhere you get your podcasts.
And follow on Twitter and Instagram at John Roa, J-O-H-N-R-O-A, roa.com. Thanks, John. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, after.
And we'll see you all next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.